Hey everyone, it's JJ. Thanks for listening to this podcast. With everything going on in this world, we decided to take a few moments and discuss what's going on. Hopefully this will help answer some questions, or even ask more questions. Please, take care of yourself, be safe, and if you can, help wherever you can. Thank you.
Well, I mean, look, this is my desk now. Like, it's two keyboards and a fucking microphone. This is insane.
It's way lamer than two turntables.
So that's my stand right there. And it was like $15 on Amazon. And I don't know how to point a camera, obviously.
No, it's very Blair Witchy with you, Paul.
Yeah.
But I also appreciate that reference is so dated. Most, if anyone's younger than me, which is a lot of people, doesn't hit home.
Yep. You know, I remember when my first set of friends pirated that movie and were freaking out because it was so scary. And then we watched it and it was so fucking lame.
It's like watching Godzilla and being terrified for your life right now.
How the fuck was that movie scary?
Well, the worst part was they did everything wrong. Like, see, I was a big camper at that point in my life because I was a Boy Scout at the time. And I watched it and all I could see was like, these people are not camping correctly. Like, I don't care. Like, I pulled apart their whole, like, what they did, where they ran, what they didn't do to set up all the camps. I was like, of course they're having a horrible time. They're not doing anything right. Like, it was really bad.
All right, JJ, give us like the TLDR on how to camp right now.
So it's been a while since I've done it. They're like really, really like camp, not like glamp, if you will.
Those that don't do teach. So teach us.
Okay. Oh, perfect. I like it. Short of it, always have your tent be highest place of your campsite. So everything flows down. So if in case it rains, water goes down the hill.
I mean, we all know shit flows downhill.
There you go. Second, as soon as you get your camp or your tent up, the first thing you should always do is get your tent up because you need to put your stuff inside of it. Then you put up your tarp.
So start by pitching your tent.
Exactly. I like it. Then put up your tarp because then you can start thinking about getting like your eating area put together. Right. And then after you do that, then you build your campfire. Your campfire should always be the last thing after everything else is set up. So in case it rains, you have shelter and you have access to your food, and then you can worry about heat. And heat is always the last thing. And make sure it's also far enough away from everything, but enough to light up the area that you need. And also don't put a fucking fire underneath a tree. That's just dumb. Because heat, fire, tree, probably not a great idea. Also,
but what if you want like a back on your chair, effectively?
Well, you should take a camping chair with you.
Yeah.
Well, but yeah. Also, be willing to, when you start breaking down your campsite, break down it the same way. So you take down your fire first, then you take down your tarp, and then take down your tent, and then when you pull everything out to take everything down your tent, you put it in your bag and then you GTFO.
Cool. So there's a process. Camping's like stack traces. Got you. First in.
There's a process. Mm-hmm. So anyway.
Sounds like hard work. My mother always had the joke that our family's idea of camping was a 4-star hotel.
Not five.
which is hilarious because I don't think we'd ever stayed at a 4-star hotel in our entire lives. Like maybe a fancy place for us was a place that didn't have your door backing directly into the parking lot.
That's fantastic.
Oh, I just realized the hilarity of her ever saying that because it is so far from true.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm like, I didn't really picture that as your childhood. No. Not that I pictured your childhood too much, but it sounds like your mom's hilarious.
I have to get this amazing sense of humor from somewhere.
Oh, I thought it was JJ's friendship.
Oh, wait. Hold on.
I see you also do jokes.
Yes.
Do I? I hear it is the word of my people. Like, you ever read that? There's a study about Hebrew and the ambiguity of Hebrew is believed to be at least partially a cause of like the wordplay that is traditionally part of the Jewish people's communication. Because fluent Hebrew isn't written with vowels. So you have to understand words by context and familiarity with exactly when people use what word in what way. So it can be quite confusing if you're learning. It's freaking near impossible if you're only learning casually. But part of that, there is some research showing that it could be part of why wordplay is so common in Jewish culture, because they freaking forgot vowels for a while.
So French is a romance language. Mm. Hebrew is a sarcasm language.
Yes. I think that's you nailed it. And I know which one I'd rather learn.
So I do love my pun. It's a really bad dad joke, but I really do love this pun. So there's a thin line between a numerator and a denominator. Only a fraction of people will get this joke. Come on.
Great joke. Come. Speaking of your people and ignorance, this is my ignorance, not your people's ignorance.
Whoa!
My ignorance. So when I first moved to the States and I went to the grocery store, there was a brand called Goya, and I always assumed that was like a Jewish brand of like kosher foods and stuff. Until I realized that it was definitely not that. It kind of sounds like a Hebrewish word, right?
It does. No, yeah. For those less in the know, there, goy is and goyim is the plural, but goyim means non-Jew. So there is kind of a perfect irony to that,
right?
Yeah. So if you're called a goyim, it's not an insult. It's just the common term for not being Jewish. So it would be it'd be the ultimate sarcasm, though, if there was a Jewish brand called Goyim.
Goyim.
Because literally meaning not Jewish. Yeah. Okay. We've gone full circle.
There's stuff going on in the world right now. Well, in the world, in our American world.
Oh, I think we can say it's going on internationally at this point. Do you see the protests in Paris and I think it was Berlin? That was just unbelievable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the French people love to burn a car. And so any excuse they have, they will overturn and set cars on fire.
Fair enough. Yeah, I think I appreciate the percentage of peaceful protesting internationally and nationally. Because, yeah, we're basically for the people living through this or going through the Groundhog's Day of the civil rights movement over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Watch as three white guys on a podcast attempt to discuss important topics that they don't really understand.
Well, yeah, let's take a moment and try to wander into it with some grace. Yeah. There, to your point, Paul, there is huge unrest internationally and nationally right now, and it's hitting home. I have the fortune, misfortune, all of the above, to live in Minneapolis, where it is the epicenter of it. Mm-hmm. George Floyd was murdered here about a week ago by police with him in custody. And it started an unbelievable amount of protests that had been a mix of so many different factors, mm-hmm. Predominantly peaceful protesting, with definitely some rioting by some definition of that, definitely some looting by some definition. But the dominant force has been peaceful protesting against police brutality. Yep. And it has really affected me in a way it hasn't in the past. And I don't feel I certainly feel shame for not seeing it earlier, but I'm not living in that anymore. I think the one of the bigger takeaways is just get the hell over ourselves, white people. And if you do find out what's going wrong, like just keep talking through your insecurity and through your ignorance and keep learning. Mostly elevate other people through it, but that silence is one of the greatest harms we can do, because when we're not silent, you see what's happening now. Like, there's as of today, there is a bill proposed to defund the Minneapolis Police Department. And there are proposals for, there are a lot of ways I'm not as familiar with yet, but there are a lot of ways to police a city or even a nation that don't involve the system of rampant abuse that we're seeing displayed. So that's my experience so far. It's I'm trying to educate myself. I'm definitely more affected than I expected, and I'm happy that I am. I'm not like happy like, yay, let's go dance in the street, but I'm happy like, shit, I got some work to do. So I don't know. Well, how's it affecting you guys?
Yeah, so like, it's hard to really put into words how it's affecting me. I definitely don't have the direct proximity to it that you have, being that you're in the epicenter. Not that we haven't had our own mostly peaceful protests here. You know, I think it's easy to protest peacefully up until the point the people you're protesting against are militarized and not afraid to use it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I guess all the talk about writing and stuff, like, I'm taking most of that with a grain of salt, because I mean, there's always going to be people that take advantage of any situation to act mischievously. Mm-hmm. And that certainly doesn't paint everyone with that same brush. And so, I mean, I feel like any of the looting and the riot, the riotous behavior that's not caused by the like police response, I don't really like, I just haven't even really seen all that much of it, let alone, you know, see it as the same issue. I'm just, you know, trying to figure out what I can do, and there is very little I can do. I can't even vote my way out of it like some folks can, because I am an immigrant to this country, which is an interesting experience in of itself, because people don't identify me as an immigrant. And so certainly I saw interesting sides of people back last year when we had a lot of similar unrest around immigration and, you know, putting Latinx folks in and children in cages and stuff. It was certainly interesting sides of people I saw then. So I feel like that probably affected me more directly than this, because I was able to have some identification with it. Whereas with this one, I'm just like, there's not a lot I can do other than speak up when I can and shut up, which is even more important, when I can.
Sometimes, yeah, we can come back to that. Like I think there are things people can do. What I'm finding so far, but I don't need to mansplain in the middle of us exploring this, because it is just a thing we're just all trying to process a little.
Yeah, JJ, the big thing. Go ahead. No, I'm done. JJ.
I'm processing what's going on. Today, I took a mental health day. I realize that's a privilege to be able to take a mental health day. I acknowledge that. But I have noticed that my mental state of realizing what is going on has actually caused me to start questioning and forcing me to ask questions in situations that I normally haven't asked questions and or tried to understand really what was happening. The thing that I'm struggling at the moment with, and which is, I don't know which questions to ask, because my interpretation of some situations, as I've talked to close friends about now, I've interpreted them wrong, and I've had a huge sense of ignorance on what was happening and what the situation was, and now I'm having to, for lack of a better term, go back to square zero. Or square one, I guess is this phrase.
That's cool. Zeros where we hang.
There you go. And I'm looking at the situations that I was like, oh, I've interpreted what's going on. The observability 101, right? I've interpreted what's going on. I can move forward now. But now that I'm really processing what's going on, I spent an hour or so this morning just sitting in my backyard looking out and just wondering about situations that I thought I understood and let my mind kind of process it. And now that I've interpreted it differently, a lot of my worldview is starting to skew. I want to help. I want to be there to elevate people who need help, but I don't know where to start. Like, it's information overload, and I'm an engineer at heart, right? That's kind of my charm. And so I'm trying to make it an engineering problem, right? But it's not. Yeah. And I don't know how to take my skill set and provide it to people who need it, so I can offer my shoulders, if you will, or my hand to lift them up, or whatever. I don't know how to.
Or your DNS records is actually what I've been thinking about. No, yeah, but for real, I noticed a friend of mine is very active in the nonprofit space in Minneapolis, and has been posting some things about like they need a place to connect people that's secure and safe. And I was DMing with them on like what options they have, like to use Signal or as a chat platform, and how phones can be tracked, and offering like, if they're setting up a website, I'll set up the DNS records for it and get it stood up. Like those are like the times where I feel lucky that I am close to people that are so close to actionable things that I feel like I can immediately get my hands on and help people with. That's something that I'm sure many, like what you were just saying, JJ, like you don't have that proximity to that kind of direct need. So it's like, how do you seek that? Not to make this just about tech, but I do kind of think about the OODA loop right now.
Yes.
Like what you're just describing, JJ, is like, I think like that's OODA in practice. Like you're taking a moment to take that step back and observe and then orient. But let's not forget like the next two parts of like decision and then action. And how you, I guess we're stuck in the orienting phase of which direction do we orient and what is actionable. I just bought a book, you know, I don't know, like I need to educate myself. So I bought a book. That's kind of my default choice. And it's How to Be an Anti-Racist by Ibram X. Kendi. I saw it everywhere on every list on what I need to learn. And it's sold out almost everywhere right now, seems rightfully so. But I thought I'd pick that up. And then my goal has been to use the platform that I have, which as little as it is, I have some followers on Twitter and Instagram and crap like that. So I've been posting about it. I've been talking to my neighbors and asking if they want to read a copy with me, and I'll buy it for them. I'll just send them a copy. And then a couple friends saw that I was doing that, so they DM'd to donate anonymously to me so that I could send out more copies. So I just sent out about 20 copies of the book to people that can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's just, everything right now feels relatively ineffective. Like, what the hell did I just do? I just played, you know, Jewish Santa Claus with some anti-racist books. That's like the minimizing of it. But then the other side of it is it's one step towards not doing nothing. Like, I'm going to read this. We're going to do a book club on Sundays and talk through it. So I think one of the bigger messages I've taken away is just like, white people need to educate white people about this stuff, because people of color are exhausted and they don't need to spend any more of their time or energy explaining shit that is very searchable. And people, you know, don't think we're the heroes of the story, but we certainly don't have to be agnostic, because I think that's harmful.
Yeah. So that book again, How to Be an Anti-Racist by
Ibram X. Kendi. That's one. There's also a great resource we can link in the show notes of it's anti-racism resources. It includes, you know, social media accounts you can follow, podcasts you can listen to. It has a huge list of books and recommendations for parents on how to talk to kids about race and racism. So really powerful work.
And I realize this just because I'm not trying to be funny, but I'm actually making a conscious effort here. I linked, you know, I found the official site for Ibram X. Kendi, and I put it in the show notes for us. Not the Amazon, but I actually found it directly from his site. So if you do look at this, it will be going directly. The proceeds are closer to the person compared to going through Amazon and getting lost in the ether that is Amazon.
Well said. Yeah, he also published through, to the best of my knowledge, it's published through Random House. So I've just been purchasing hardcover copies from Random House because I know those are the most profitable for the author. Mm-hmm. And I've emailed and tweeted at Random House a couple times to see if they're willing to match donations of books. So
a friend of mine that's an author said that he makes the most money when people buy the book off him.
Oh, cool.
Because he buys the book from the publisher, which he gets paid on. Mm-hmm. And then he makes the profit on you buying it from him.
Oh, hell yeah. So any way,
if at all possible, always buy directly from the author if you have a vested interest in like helping that author specifically.
Hell yes, that's great. And there are a ton of other really good books. I think rightfully Ibram's book has been at the top of the list, but there's a lot more to learn, and I'm trying to figure out, I'll be really honest and say I was scared to protest here. Like I saw people injured that were, I know were being peaceful. They came back with huge bruises from gigantic rubber bullets being shot directly at them and being shot with freaking, whether you call it, whatever you want to call it, kind of gas, that the toxic gas that's being sent to people. And it scared the shit out of me, man.
Yeah, and it's not hard to get embroiled in the dangerous side of it. A few years ago, I was in Paris during one of the Yellow Jacket things, and I was just trying to find my hotel and ended up surrounded inside a cloud of tear gas because I turned the wrong way. Well, I didn't actually turn the wrong way. It was happening outside the front of my hotel, but you know.
They knew.
So even just being in the proximity of it can be super dangerous. So I can totally see why you would be concerned about, you know, going to or near the protests.
But what I'll say is I did help clean up this past weekend. There were buildings burnt down. Like some were very beloved Black establishments that were definitely not burned down by people that frequent them.
Right.
And that was really encouraging. There are thousands of people out and so many people carrying brooms that it felt like a citywide Quidditch match.
Nice. Nice.
So, it was the one joke I allowed myself this weekend. It was pretty freaking funny. But it was really, really encouraging.
I don't get that. Is that from Mary Poppins?
It's cool. It's a Harry Potter reference.
So I'm one of my OODA loops that I'm going through is I'm asking the questions. And I genuinely would like to know this answer. When you saw people coming together to help clean up, mm-hmm. and you saw that there were thousands of people helping clean up, which is amazing humanity, like that shows the people coming together, right? Honest question. Was there a police presence there too?
Oh, great question. I walked down probably 2 miles of Lake Street over a 4-hour period. I saw only police I saw were on the roof of the precinct in the area that was fenced off. So short answer was no. There were no police that on Saturday when I was around that I observed. Yeah. And I'm really thankful for that at this point.
I can only imagine. But so I realize I'm seeding the question, right, by that statement. Yeah. But it feels weird, right? Like, obviously, if they're there to, again, I'm asking the questions because I'm processing, right? If they're there to help society as police, that's what they're told, that we're told from a very young age, you're in trouble, you go find a police officer, right? Or that's what the ideal way is, right? Obviously not. Anyway, now, if we had protests happen one night, that they were there to do their thing, and now you come again the next morning and they're not there, and it's possible, like, obviously I was not there, so I don't know, but it's possible there is even more people there cleaning up, right? Like, it's possible. That seems like a really weird duality. Like, how do you explain or process this as someone who's observing the situation? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying, of like, what's the difference between the police presence at the protest in the night versus the cleanup the next day?
Because isn't that the same, that they're there for crowd control, right? In essence, that is their job, is crowd control, to make sure that riots don't happen. Like, in a very specific way of describing duties, right?
Sure.
They're there for crowd control. If there's going to be more people showing up to help clean up, shouldn't, like, it's just like, I realize,
don't you still need crowd control? Yeah, no, I exactly. See your point. You're just like, yeah. Again, back to your engineer mind, you're just like, situation parallels other situation, why is this incongruent? You know, I think there is one reasonable differentiation of, like, the cover of night versus daytime.
Okay.
There is an element there that I get, like, it's easier for things to happen at night and to escalate at night. That's the story I would tell myself if I believed in them anymore. But, like, mm-hmm. where I'm at right now is that, like, it's not about helping people. It was about controlling certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. And there weren't any protest signs. Those people with shovels and brooms mm-hmm. cleaning up broken glass and putting out burning buildings, because there aren't enough firefighters for all the fires that were going on.
So I think the evening, the protests, people are there to try and tear down a racist establishment.
Okay.
Right? The next day in the morning, they're there to clean up. Right?
Okay.
And so there's some intent on the protesting. And I don't mean like malicious intent, but I just mean from like the police perspective, they don't need to do crowd control for a bunch of people cleaning up, right?
Yeah.
I would argue
they don't need to do the crowd control during a protest either, because that has almost always, well, from what I've seen, has actually always been the actual thing that has turned it from being a peaceful protest into a non-peaceful protest.
Absolutely.
Is the response from the people that are supposed to be controlling the crowd, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, the whole point of a protest is an uncontrolled crowd,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you're mm-hmm. protesting against the form of control, right? You're protesting against something to do with the establishment.
Well, it was like the old free speech zones that we used to have. Remember those? Did you ever hear about this during?
I'm not familiar with this term.
I think the last term the G8 summit was here in New York or something like that. They had free speech zones, which were fenced off areas for protesters to stand, which is, if you imagine that for a moment, like, that seems really, like, weird. And now, obviously, society is much different now, but it's hard to as I said at the very beginning, it's hard for me to process what's going on, to be able to get my hands wrapped around, or my my mind wrapped around the situation. So I feel like I can, first of all, not say something completely and utterly dumb, which I probably already have, and I haven't even realized it.
Oh, I definitely have.
And then I want to be an ally. I want to stand up and say that this is wrong. This is not right. Or not correct, I guess is the better way of
JJ,
saying it.
JJ, you don't need to understand it to do those things, because a lot of the issues you and I can never understand, because we've never been subject to real racism, right? We've never been subject to real oppression. So understanding those things and what it's like to have that experience is out of our grasp.
But can't it be empathetic of it though?
That's a different thing though.
Yeah, I like the point of like, you can learn, but you don't need to learn in order to take action. So I like the separation of those two things. Okay. If you know it's still wrong, you can start taking action even as you're still confused as all hell as to why or what or how. You can still start doing what, like, you know, it's kind of an appeal. It's a trust thing. You're trusting in other people that you agree with on this subject.
Yes.
And you're taking action based on their advice. I think that's the best a lot of us can do right now. And then you slowly filter on what advice was best, and then you inform yourself along the way, and you might then be able to orient yourself with less advice. But for us, especially all three of us, we're going to need advice from people who are actually experiencing this pain, not us, not just our empathetic pain, not just our imagined understanding of what it might be like. So we're forever going to be a little wrong. But I think
we can't be leaders in this. We can only be doers, right? And we need to find the people that are leaders, who are the people that have and are experiencing it, and also have the drive and the words and the skills to create actionable things and lead people. And then we can glom onto them, and we can use their leadership as a way to figure out what it is we should be doing. I mean, I think there's plenty of obvious low-hanging fruit, but I think the real systemic change isn't going to happen from us just picking up those things. I think the real systemic change is when we find the people that are actually really affected by the system, that are willing to put in the work to lead us out of it, and then to do whatever we can to help them.
And they're out there. Yes. So it's on us to go find those people and follow them.
Yes.
I'll say, like, I'd separate out, like, we shouldn't be leading this big vision, but like, you can lead a little project.
Of course.
Of like, the first project we all have is go talk to all of the people you're related to about this. Like, about what you're experiencing, ideally, with, if you need to inform yourself more before doing that, do that. But like, that is something we all carry now. And then there's, it kind of scales from there, where if you do see a project of like, hey, this organization needs a chat platform, like, use your Kubernetes powers for good and like set up Rocket Chat for them and give them the encryption and privacy they need to do that. And one of the things, I found an open source project that removes metadata from images and helps you blur out faces very quickly. And like, as soon as I saw that, just like, start pushing that out to every organization I can find, because that's going to be important right now.
Yeah. One thing I saw just the other day that I thought was really poor timing and poorly done was Zoom announced that they wouldn't be offering encryption to free users because they want to work closely with the police.
Oh yeah, that was a tone deaf move.
That's a thing you want to be doing right now. So I think, you know, even there, like, if you know of a system that does do end-to-end encryption by default, like, we should be pushing people and helping people find those things. Because things don't change, they could get worse, and having people's conversations and records subpoenable by these companies that are willing to be complicit is a real problem. And so, you know, can we, like, the Google, not Hangouts, Google Teams or Microsoft Hangouts or whatever now, are they all end-to-end encryption? Can we use them? Do we need to think about standing up a, like,
public Jitsi server?
Like, a friend of mine was setting up a Jitsi server, like, a few weeks ago. And I was, like, laughing at him and calling him an idiot, saying, why would you do this? And now I'm like, oh, actually, maybe helping an organization, a group of people run a Jitsi server is a good idea.
That's a real, I would call that some real value add. If you reach out and they say, yes, I could use this, then freaking do it. Or stand one up and see who says, yes, I need this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Like, those are ways in which, like, we are uniquely skilled.
Right.
And that's just amazing. So a couple of coworkers of mine on the marketing side are SEO experts, and they're volunteering right now to get some of the research on racial injustice in the United States to trend. So it's far easier to find through Google instead of, you know, other points. I'm like, use those talents, but they don't really show up on your lap. And I think that we'll all have to face the fact that we all, part of the education is finding places to help. Donations also help a lot too. We donated to a few different local locations, and not just rebuilding Lake Street, which, you know, I care about all those businesses, I frequent them, but this isn't about rebuilding just Minneapolis. It's about social justice and civil rights, first and foremost. So donating to civil rights organizations that have great records. And
can I put you on the spot for a moment about the donations? Would you be willing to send me a list so I can add it to these show notes that when we start, so we can have a list of, obviously there are always people who want to take advantage of these types of things, and it'd be really nice to have a curated list of, yes, these are the ones that we should be donating to.
Yeah, I won't say it will be an exhaustive list, but I'm happy to send one. We just got one from the LDF, they have actionable advice, and then they list out, like, the Bail Project and BOLD, which is Black Organizing for Leadership and Dignity, the Force Trajectory Project, and all the, like, a bunch of ones I was not familiar with at all and are doing really good work and are verified in doing that. Speaking of ones that aren't, I mentioned I was giving donations, and I got a couple seemingly automated DMs from people pretending that they needed funds because their business burnt down and they just had a baby. And what was freaky to me was just how it wasn't like a brand new account. And after DMing back and forth, I asked them, like, hey, could we jump on a call or something to talk through this? I would love to hear more about your story. And they just stopped responding. There's definitely, we got to, you know, be trusting right now of people, but when reaching out to individuals, definitely kind of verify things.
Yeah.
They weren't asking for a Bitcoin address, were they?
They sent me a PayPal link. And after they didn't get back to me for 2 days, I reported them there. It's just weird, unfortunate, but it's definitely just one of those things people will take advantage. So there's also a thing I've been doing, because it's very important we have these conversations. It's important we stay there, but it can be overwhelming when you're talking to people for the first time in a while. So I have been asking, like, hey, what would we be talking about, like, 2 weeks ago? Like, because we haven't talked in 8 months. What would we talk about 2 weeks ago? I tend to get a laugh, and then we have a conversation about lives again. So I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it's been useful to not overwhelm people right now. Have you found any strategies or tips you'd give for people trying to have conversations, but you know, not get overwhelmed in it?
Yeah, I think the only one I've re-remembered is like, there's a point where having the conversation isn't productive, unfortunately. And so know when to just cut that person out. And
that's a fair point.
It's difficult when it's close friends or family. So you need to figure out where your line is drawn there. But certainly, I think at this point, there's a certain amount of behavior and attitude that we just can't tolerate anymore. And that may mean saying goodbye to some people. Certainly, any sort of behavior like that you see on any of the social media platforms, you should be immediately at least like unfriending, unfollowing them, right? Because, you know, there's definitely a kind of a thought that when you follow someone, you're endorsing them. And so, you know, for A, not having that toxicity in your life is going to probably help you, but also making sure you're not associated with that person is also not a bad defensive mechanism. Not that we need to be worried about our own defenses right now, but at the same time, like, there's no need to go searching for extra aggravation.
Well said. Yeah, I think there's there is a lot of that happening in my life. I'll say, like, you know, adjust this, your tolerance level. Like, I can tolerate some conflict with people without feeling too overwhelmed. And I've tried to embrace that and like think of that as another skill I can give right now. So I've talked to people that are like, yeah, this, like, sure, people died, but this looting is unacceptable. Like, there are people, I call this racial minimizing. Like, I don't think it's maybe a passive racism for sure, but it's not active, and it's I think it's unintentional. But like, the minimizing is the problem, and I think I found coming at those people and just categorizing them as yet another racist, I think it loses an opportunity to have a conversation with people that might. So I'm not an expert in this stuff, but I'm also not scared to be wrong on that. And I've had some conversations with people in technology, especially across a lot of people don't come from privileged backgrounds that end up making pretty good money in tech. So it's a broad range of experiences, broad range of belief systems. So I find like there is room for those conversations with people. If you can get away from the name calling up front.
Yeah. If you can really humanize it, I think that's, those types of conversations are probably ones that have to be in person, person to person, to make sure that the right nuance and the right understanding and the right body language are all involved, because it's so difficult to have a conversation like that. So back to my social media stuff, like, don't try and argue on Facebook over that stuff, because I don't think that it ever really works.
Yeah. I'll say, like, it is, my only difference there would be it's ideally in person, and you know, we're also in a global that's redundant. We're in a pandemic right now, so it's, nothing is ideal right now.
Right.
So use the tools you have. If you can get off of social media and onto a phone call, awesome.
That's kind of what I was meaning.
Cool.
By in person, like person to person, as opposed to, you know, wall to wall.
How terrible is it that we're considering phone calls to be person to person these days?
Look, I'll take whatever I can get right now, because it has been a hot minute since I have been person to person with anyone.
Yeah, same.
Matt, when was the last time you hugged somebody who wasn't your wife?
Oh God, 3 months, right?
Right.
And I hug everybody.
right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's wrong. You're a good hugger too, Paul. You too, wow. JJ. Really lean into it.
I'm just a big teddy bear.
I don't think we intended to take up a whole conversation, but it's certainly warranted. So I'm just going to say thank you guys for talking. I think if you are listening and you are also uncomfortable with these subjects, but willing to explore, please check out the show notes and keep talking to us and others about it, because it's certainly not going away and it's very important.